Thank you, Nick. Thanks very much for those speakers. I'd now like to open it up to questions and contributions. So we next 15 minutes. So if you've got any questions and contributions, please.
You spoke about the decision not to engage in war in Syria as a sign of progress, which you attribute in part to changes in attitudes, which were manifest 10 years ago in the anti-Iraq war demonstrations. So when we reconvene here in 10 years' time, what do you think we can reasonably hope to be celebrating in the way of progress? And what steps do you think need to be taken towards achieving that?
Do you want us to answer there?
Do you want... Is there any more questions?
I was just going to mention, since you were mentioning Martin Luther King, a very inspirational organisation called September the 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, and they created their name from a quotation from Martin Luther King, who said that weapons are poor tools for the creation of peaceful tomorrows. And actually, since you mentioned quite a lot about Christianity, quotation as well, blessed are the peacemakers. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and my view of the kingdom of heaven is heaven on earth. I don't believe in an afterlife. I think, you know, if the Stop the War Coalition can make sure that it keeps up with what September the 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows are doing around the world, because they've set up and linked with peace movements in a lot of countries around the world, and continue to speak up in the United States against the vicious circle of war. I think that's a good thing. I find them very inspirational.
Okay.
Roger, I'm interested in the industrial arms race, because I think this is one of the things that I think we can do something about, because historically in this region we had a lot of armaments. I mean, Armstrong's factory, I think he provided guns to both sides in the American Civil War, and we've been a sort of region that's participated in an industrial military complex. And I'd be interested to know partly what the University of Newcastle gets funding in terms of its defence budget and sort of expenditure on technology. But I'm also interested in the stuff that Claire referred to about the drone warfare and the artificial intelligence and all of that stuff, because I'm aware that the Israelis and British companies have now cooperated together, and I think the whole future of this kind of development is really quite scary. I mean, I think, you know, you've got the NSA and all those revelations from Snowden, but you can also see how the link with Google and artificial intelligence, I think, spreads, you know, real frightening stuff about a dystopian future. So I'd be interested a little bit about that industrial military complex. Final point, very interesting, after the vote in August 2013 that effectively led to America not going into Syria, Lockheed had a big drop in their share price. Why? Because every cruise missile or Tomahawk missile costs, you know, what is it, $500,000 or something like that? So they were expecting to spend a lot of money, receive a lot of money in payments. So I'm interested in that link, because I think we have to try and challenge some of that.
I'd be interested to hear the ideas, the plans, the vision that people have to turn the situation around. So we've listened to all the arguments that we can put forward against armaments, against war and for peace. But I haven't heard, you know, a vision of this is the way we can do things. This is the alternative, or this is one alternative. I'd like to hear something along those lines, please.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just, I mean, keep in touch on something that I wanted to ask about, and I think all three of the presentations that were had touched on how power corrupts and the tendency for elites to succumb to hubris, you know, to believe that they're beyond reproach and that their ideology is beyond question. We definitely saw that in Bush and Blair, or almost messianic affirmations of that they have a righteous power and they know what they're doing is right, regardless of what other people are saying. They know that they're right. But I'm interested in the link between war and democracy, and democracy being used as a justification to go to war, but also the hypocrisy of using that for a justification in light of the NSA, you know, revelations about the amount of digital surveillance, but also on attacks on the right to protest in our own country, and yet we're using democracy is an excuse to go to other countries about preserving their freedom, their liberty and their privacy, and yet we're using quite draconian methods in our own country to keep protests down. So I was wondering if you could sort of also comment on the use of the internet and social media and sort of, and how that's a challenge.
I'm going to take one more and then...
In terms of the next 10 years and what we could achieve over the next decade and where we want to be, the first thing is that we need to secure and build on the breakthrough over Syria, because it was a fantastic breakthrough for the movement, for public opinion, anti-war public opinion, and so on, to stop an assault on Syria, which would have made things worse, and they're already horrifically bad in Syria. That civil war even worse. And we need to make sure that that becomes a permanent change, stopping that pursuit of war, stopping the idea that these issues are dealt with through military intervention. Because they will be back in the future, and they will be raising the spectre of that kind of military intervention. We don't know in which country, but that will be happening again in the future. So we need to secure that victory and secure that breakthrough. Second thing is to stop the rise of drone warfare. This is now a major part of how America conducts its operations around the world. There are several different countries, most notably Pakistan, which has been the main victim of drones, but a number of other countries like Somalia and Yemen. Countries where there has been no declaration of war, where there has been no invasion or anything like that, there's been no resolutions passed in the United Nations, but nonetheless they have intervened in those countries and killed people through drones. And we need to reassert as an alternative to that the basic idea that it is not acceptable for a powerful country to kill people in another country because of its own very particular objectives that it has, and the human cost is horrendous there. So we need to stop that. And I think particularly in this country, we need to stop any British participation in drones, because that has increased in the last year or two, and we need to stop that from happening. And the third thing that I would raise is trident replacement, as we mentioned. We talk about £70 or £80 billion worth of spending here. This is directly linked to austerity. The fact is that austerity is a choice. It's not the case that the money is not there. The point is that the priorities are wrong. They are twisted and inhumane priorities that the system has. And money which could be spent on protecting and preserving vital public services, people's jobs, social security, and so on, is instead spent on weapons which will hopefully never be used. The alternative that they are using is more horrific. A massive waste of money. And so I think changing the priorities is the goal there. Stopping that disgusting waste of spending, and instead campaigning for the protection of our public services and stopping austerity, is an absolutely crucial goal.
Thank you. Can I just get some answers to the question first? Would you like to?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the question about where we'll be in 10 years' time, I suppose you could say, is anybody's guess. But there obviously are certain trends. I mean, it seems to me the Middle East is now in the most appalling state. That Iraq, there's very serious fighting a few weeks ago in Fallujah, brought about by the government. It's becoming much more of a sectarian battle over there, but it's very serious. The situation in Syria is obviously breaking up. You've got intervention by all the powers, really. You've got most of the immediate regional powers intervening, and you've also got wider powers. You know, you've got the United States, you've got Russia, you've got all the different powers. It struck me last August that you could have had a situation where you had a much bigger war. Now, luckily, I think because of what happened in the Parliament, that didn't happen, but it could have been. Had that attack gone ahead, had it then involved Turkey very directly, had Saudi Arabia come in, had Iran come in, all these things which were definitely possibilities, and Israel, you could have a very big war in the Middle East with all the problems. If you look at the origins of the First World War, you know, it starts with all sorts of quite accidental little factors, but everybody knows it's about the build-up of, well, from the scramble for Africa to 1914, there's this build-up of imperial rivalry that's going on again. So there's that problem. There's a pivot to the Pacific, which I referred to, where the United States has made the decision to pour more and more resources into that. You'd think they kind of, with all the disasters that they've already been involved in, they wouldn't be doing this, but they are. So this is going to be a major arena of conflict. I'm not saying it will be a big war, but there is increasing economic rivalry between China and the United States, which obviously is having an effect. And then, if you then look at Africa, there's a great deal of Chinese investment in Africa. There's a great deal of rivalry happening here because of the huge number of natural resources there are in Africa. So you've got the potential for all of these things. And what, I forget who referred to it about the, I think Alex, about the number of countries where they're intervening without actually intervening, if you like, Somalia and Yemen and all these places. Incredibly poor countries which they're attacking with drones. They back one side against another with no real kind of understanding of what the consequences will be. So I think, so to put it, I suppose, briefly, you have the potential for all those wars. You also have the potential for people to say, we don't want these to happen. And I think that's what we have to that's what we have to continue to build. And I think it's good in Britain. We do have anti-war and peace movements. I think we need a lot more of these around the world for the reasons that people have said. Just very quickly on the other points that people made, I agree very much about drones. I think that it's a way of stopping your own population from being killed. Now, America have been quite good at this for a long time, with the exception of Vietnam, which caused some huge political problems. They don't, by and large, take the biggest casualties in the wars that they're involved in, and they're very good at using technology. The drones are an attempt to be able to do this even when there isn't a declared war, and that's what's quite serious about it. And coinciding with that, you do have attacks on the right to protest in this country and elsewhere. And I mean, for example, this week, it's not the right to protest, but a man called Mohsen Beg was arrested and is still in Birmingham police station somewhere, supposedly accused of terrorist offences. Now, I have no idea what he's accused of or what he may or may not have been doing. But Mohsen Beg, as a number of people probably in this room will know, is an extremely articulate campaigner who spent several years in Guantanamo Bay. He's extremely involved in all sorts of things about surveillance and challenging torture, which we know has been going on. So I have to say, I find it very disturbing that he's been arrested. Now, as I say, I don't know what the issues are, but this is the kind of thing that I feel this is the security services really not wanting him to be able to speak out, and I hope very much that isn't the case. Just finally on the vision about, you know, we've talked a lot about what's terrible about wars and what is the vision for an alternative. Well, I'm a socialist. I think that actually war is a product. It's not just a product of capitalism. Obviously, it goes back before capitalism, but it is a product of dividing a society into classes where some people have wealth and some people don't, and that therefore there are constant conflicts over the wealth in society. And that is, if you want to strip down what wars are about, that is what they're about. And I think only when you change a system like that will you be able to begin to talk about a vision where we can have utopian discussions about what we'd like education to be like, what we'd like housing to be like, what we'd like all these things to be like, rather than the kind of the situation we're in now, where other speakers have referred to. I mean, wars are absolutely terrible things for for civilians, and most of the conflict now, it's the civilians that get killed or raped or become refugees. These are the main things that happen to them. And we've got to find a better way of organising the world.
Industrial arms race and University of Newcastle, Nick?
Yeah, Matthew, do you know anything about university funding?
That's a great way, you always deflect the answer to someone.
Well, one of our colleagues, Rachel, there was a Campaign Against the Arms Trade was writing a report.
Actually, called, I've just written down Campaign Against
called,
the Arms Trade.
Called Study War No More. Did you read that? So Matthew's in my department, he's a colleague.
I think there are connections between Newcastle University and a company who has shares or has some affiliation with a large arms manufacturer. In fact, it causes some people not to sign up for the pension scheme because they don't want to be, I've heard, but I don't know the specifics of it.
Yeah.
It's a good question.
It was.
I did write on behalf of Campaign Against Arms Trade. This was a few years back to Newcastle University. And certainly they admitted that they had investments in armaments. And they said, well, it would be a very strange thing if we gave this up because we, we have, young cadets, we have army cadets. And we wrote back and said, yes, but do not realise that these very weapons that you're investing in could kill your army cadets. And we didn't get
a reply to
that.
Right. No, this the broad question I think you, Kath, put and others were asking, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do in 10 years? Well, you can do what you can. You can do what you can. So a few years ago, there was one of the big publishers of academic journals is a company called Elsevier, one of these great corporations that has its finger in lots of different pies. And The Guardian did an undercover inquiry. And it was running an arms trade, an arms fair. And undercover, the Guardian journalist found you could get electric shock batons and other banned items.
Control your students.
My department has actually just bought a drone. But I think it's to measure land use and water change in the Cotchet catchment up
that's
in
what
the
they tell you.
That's what they tell us, yeah.
No. And that's what you're telling us.
So a group of us, and some Newcastle academics are quite involved in this, we organised a boycott of this company who published a lot of the journals, and we said, we're not going to write and you publish for your journals. And I had a contract to do various stuff for an encyclopedia for them. I said, I'm not going to do it. And lots of us across the country did it, and they decided to disinvest in the arms fairs because journals were most of what they did, and this arms fair was a little bit. So that was a victory. You know? So you do what you can. There was a guy in the department, one of the a different department here, he's head of a department. When he was a postgrad student, he had a certain amount of funding for engineering from the MOD. And he became Christian, crisis of conscience, and said, I'm not going to take this, and chose not to take this funding. And this could have ruined his career, but he's now head of a department in this university. You know? So you make these moral choices, you do what you can. You mentioned the September 11th families. That's an example. You know, thankfully, most of us won't have been bereaved in that way, but the families of people who were bereaved on September 11th, who went to Afghanistan and said, we are opposing this war in Afghanistan. We forgive the people who did this. We don't want violence on families here. This really wrong-footed the Bush administration. What do you do? Okay, because these are the people whose names we're fighting in for their in justice for them, but they don't want us to fight for them. This got a lot of attention and publicity. You do what you can. If you're a member of a trade union, you encourage that trade union to build alliances with trade unions in other countries and ask, how can we support peace movement there? You move your trade union into exactly the sort of thing that we so respect Claire for doing in her work with us in Stop the War. If you're a school teacher, the anniversaries, the World War I centenary is coming up. One of the things that we're doing in Newcastle is getting resources for teachers to focus this Christmas on the Christmas truces. I did a trial thing with a group of 9-year-olds. I got them reenacting trench warfare, throwing balls over the. This is a game where they throw balls, as many balls the other side as they can, in a minute, and the other team throws them back, and at the end you see who's won. Instead of giving, saying who's won, okay, you're going, now we have biscuits and orange juice, after giving them a talk on the Christmas truces. So, you creative, if you're a teacher, you creatively think, how can I teach anti-militaristic ideas in the curriculum? Two final examples for me. I'm a Christian, and as I've said, I'm dismayed at when the church supports militarism. And so one of my roles, I'm a chaplain here at the university, involved in church networks internationally, is to try and challenge the church to think, okay, we've got it wrong many times, let's return to the example of the peacemaking Jesus and ask, what does this mean for our investments? What does this mean for how we form alliances with peace movements and unions, etc. like this? Two fine examples I want to mention. There's one of my friends, she researches a group called the San Jose Peace Community in Colombia, and this was a group of people lived in who suffered from the violence of the state and the violence of paramilitaries, and they said, we are going to create a non-weaponized zone. No one's going to come in here. And they suffered lots of attacks, and so you've got groups like Fellowship of Reconciliation and Christian Peacemaker Teams go from Britain and America and use their bodies essentially to shield them. And this has worked because paramilitaries and the government are afraid of killing American bodies because Americans support the state. And so this has had an impact there. Right, at the other end of the spectrum, ideas matter. Ideas really do matter. Why did the Cold War end? There's lots of arguments can be made, but one of the reasons it ended was that the Soviet Union decided it could coexist with the West. In Lenin's thinking, a war between capitalism and the Soviet capitalist powers and the Soviet Union was inevitable. So the Soviet Union constantly planned for different wars. When Gorbachev came to power, he decided actually the Soviet Union could coexist with the West. We don't need to fight them. He didn't want to end the Soviet Union, that's a different thing. And so he said that to the Eastern European countries, we will no longer intervene in your internal affairs. The Cold War, the most dangerous period in history, came to an end. How did it come to an end? Well, his advisors, people like Georgi Arbatov, had been involved in these networks of scientists and Christians over the decades, and they were persuaded that coexistence could happen. Ideas can change the world. So how are we going to change the world? Do what you can, where you can.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to pick up. So I think sometimes it can feel a bit overwhelming. So as a trade unionist in the public sector at the minute, I think quite a lot of us feel overwhelmed, particularly in this region. There's lots of jobs going. And I think that can lead you to thinking, well, I'm an individual, what can I do? But of course, one of the whole reasons I'm a trade union activist and is because I'm an optimist and I believe you can change things, but I think there's hard evidence that you can change opinion. So the fact that we've been able to have an influence on the view of people like Tony Blair, who did take us into an illegal war, has meant that other decision makers will think much more about that. I think the fact that other examples, if we think, I was thinking about this when you were speaking, in terms of we had the BNP in this region, targeted the region, stood in every seat in Sunderland, targeted places in Newcastle, and actually people came together and stopped those racist ideas being the prevalent ideas. I think, from an economic perspective, I remember when this government first came to power, it was universally felt that everyone said there was no alternative to austerity, we had to implement the cuts, but actually the majority of public opinion doesn't share that view anymore. So for me, I think at times when you can think, well, as an individual, what can I do? There's something about reminding yourself that if you come together with other people, actually you can build mass movements that sometimes can feel quite small when you're in smaller groups, but actually if you connect them up, do have a power in them and a dynamic that can make a difference. I think in terms of my vision, it's definitely that we would have a society that instead of investing, what was it you said, Nick? £1 trillion?
Trillion dollars worldwide
on arms. We actually invest that in public services, hospitals, schools. We invest that like that so that the millions of kids dying without access to clean water, that can be solved overnight if there was a will. I think we do need to promote alternatives economically, but also socially. I think we need to think about political alternatives and holding political decision makers to account. I think one of the things when we think about democracy and linking to the fact that it is hypocritical, I think we talk about democracy in other countries, but actually democracy in our own country is still lacking. You know, I can think as a trade unionist, there's been great gains made around equal pay as an example, but actually men still earn more than women in many areas of life. We've got people who can, you know, who are swimming with money and wealth, and other people who actually are reliant on a handout from a food bank. What I think, though, is that society does go through phases, as Lindsay said, but I think things at the minute are so bad, actually there is such a growing disproportionate impact around poverty and inequality, that people naturally, as human beings, start to say, hang on, you know what, this isn't right, it has gone too far. I think this government actually have underestimated people's inbuilt humaneness to say, we don't think it's right that people are starving. You know what, we don't want you going to war in our name, and we're not going to allow you to do that. But you only change things if you come together with other people to share those visions. And I think sometimes that can feel quite difficult. I think for all of us, you know, sometimes you're at work, you're struggling to pay the bills at the minute, life is tough. But it's why it's important that we do work together, you know, from different perspectives, trade unionists, campaigning groups, faith groups, Stop the War, anti-racist groups, because when you all add that up, there's actually quite a lot of people campaigning against what can feel like the predominant view of society. You know, you turn on Radio 4 in the morning, I'm always in a dilemma now, so I put it on when I'm getting ready for work, but it makes me angry and I want to smash the radio because it's such biased reporting with no challenge. But actually, the reality is there are lots of people who want to challenge that. But, of course, because of capitalism, we have a massive job to even get our views in the media. I would say people like Seamus Milne, who wrote a fantastic article in The Guardian, actually, a few weeks back about the whole World War One stuff. John Pilger, there are people there, but we've got a job of work to do to challenge some of those ideas. I think your point about, you know, pensions, Unison's been doing a campaign around ethical investment of pensions. You know, public sector pensions are being invested in all sorts of unethical and frankly quite dodgy places. We can do something about that, and we need to, because it's not right actually that poor people who need pensions end up not having a pension because they don't want their money going to some dictatorship. But, you know, again, we can stand up and challenge things like that. And we can make a difference. So I guess for me, my great aim is that we do bring people together to challenge, because I absolutely believe that we can get a different type of society. I think at the minute it feels hard, but we've got to get that through the democratic processes we've currently got whilst trying to build alternatives. I think one of the things we need to think about is, you know, people are elected on fewer and fewer percentages at the minute because people are becoming so alienated from that democratic process, and we need to think about how we engage people in that. I think your point, Nick, about boycotts work, you think about apartheid, who would have thought at the start of that that movement would actually end up where it did. Again, talking about revisionism, I thought it was absolutely fascinating and abhorrent when Mandela died, all these people who had said he was a terrorist actually were suddenly saying, my God, this great man of peace is dead. That's why I think meetings like this and remembering the reality and challenging revisionism is really important, because we learn from the past, and the arguments that have been used in the past to justify war are exactly the same that are being used now and will be used in the future, and that's why we need to come together and campaign against them and challenge them. I believe we can make gains, small gains that build to larger gains, and I think we've all got a part to play in that.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
Yes, I would like to ask the gentleman there. I had a peculiar situation in Sunderland. The street preacher.
Yeah.
Sorry. preachers in Sunderland who were always stopping and listening to them, and they found me bored, and they're nice people. They said they didn't care about Cameron. They didn't care about Rose. They didn't care about anything because they read Isaiah.
All right.
So how would you answer that?
With difficulty.
No, not with... Do you want to do more questions or individual? Or?
Is there any other questions? Because we're going to have to draw it to a close soon, so is there any other questions? Or should we just answer what we've got and then we can conclude?
I think Nick's going to have to answer.
Yeah. I'm with you on that, Lindsay.
Yeah, and this is part relates to a point that you made, the kingdom of heaven, is it now or whatever. You know, there's a sort of Sunday school view that there's something called heaven. It's a sort of ghostly place that people go to when you die. That's not a biblical idea. You know, the Bible looks forward to the return of Jesus and the making of a new heaven and a new earth where everything is put right, where social relations are restored. And we live in the light of that because, you know, because in Christian thought Jesus died and rose again, there is hope for everyone. And because Jesus became a human being, the world matters. The world matters. Human life matters. Sunderland matters. My half my family were from Sunderland originally, so Sunderland matters. So what I'd say to your preacher is, that's good, you know. Isaiah's great, but Isaiah's great critique of the rulers of his day was that they were unjust. They were not caring for the poor. It's no good saying you follow Jesus, the Prince of Peace, who lived amongst the poor and challenged poverty, if you yourselves don't care for the God's creation. So that's what I'd say to him.
Okay. Right, would you like to sum up? Start with
no,
prayer?
No, I think I've said enough. I'm fine.
You said, okay. Okay, I'd like to thank everyone for coming tonight. And I'd just like to add to what the speakers were saying about the vision that we have to turn the situation around, because I think that was a very important question, and obviously that some very good answers were given. But one of the things I think we should look at is that we are that alternative. Mm-hmm. This anti-war movement that we've all fought for 11 years to build, to unite people from all different walks of life, different beliefs, different religions, created some fantastic opposition to these warmongers, and actually if we can take that forward and take it into government, into an anti-war government as it were, you know, there's a bright future for everyone, because we know that people are responding to the anti-war movement. That's why we celebrated marking that vote against the attack on Syria, because it was very, very significant, and that's one of the main reasons for the meeting. So just on that note, I think it is going to be a bright future, and I agree with Nick. You've got to always start from hope, but that's got to be that's based on actual reality, not just on wishing it. It's actually happening. People around the world are organising against war, and we will win. Just to conclude, I'd just like to thank the speakers very much for their contributions tonight. It's been a really good meeting. It's not been the biggest meeting we've organised, but it's been a really good meeting, and it's gone into quite a lot of issues. But the Stop the War Coalition movement goes on, and we've got an organising meeting on Monday at Muslim Welfare House, if anyone's interested in coming to organise with the Newcastle Stop the War Coalition. On March the
20th,
yeah, we've got a No Glory to War meeting, which is actually in this same hall, 5:30, 5:30 to 7 p.m. And it's Dr. Clive Barrett from Bradford and Dr. Neil Faulkner from Bristol. That's all the details I have. If you're interested in that meeting, speak to Nick after the meeting.
Should we briefly say what it's about?
Do you think? Tony, you're going to announce that.
Yeah, and it's basically it's a campaign this year, sort of countering the celebratory myths that the government is putting out about the Centennial Award. There's a pamphlet here, if people want to have a look at it, and it's basically launching our campaign locally on the No Dory campaign, so we're wanting to get everybody involved in that. Nick was talking about the work he's doing with students and schools. And I know we're working with Unison, looking at possibly producing some Christmas cards at the end of the year to celebrate that century. So it should be a really good opportunity to get that campaign moving. So have a look at that. There are other books here as well. There's Lindsay's book, Century of War That Changed Lives here. And there's it talks about the Century of War. There's a War With No End, a series of essays here with people like John Berger and Andy Courage and Naomi Klein.
The other thing to point out is that we are looking to organise in May a meeting on the Scramble for Africa, and then towards the end of the year, I believe nationally, maybe Lindsay can mention, but we're looking at some protest against NATO in Wales.
Yeah, that's the last weekend. There's a NATO summit in just outside Newport in South Wales, which is the first week of September. But there will be a counter summit and protests starting the weekend before and all that week. I know it's a long way from Newcastle, but I mean, there's ways of getting there, probably not verging cross-country, but anyway, it'd be great if you can publicise that. We're also getting a guy over in October called Adam Hochschild, who's written a very good book, whose title totally escapes me at the moment, but about protest and opposition to World War One, and he's coming over. We're going to do a conference, and we're also thinking...
To End All Wars,
that's right. It's a very, very good book. And we're also seeing if he can come for long enough... Mm. Whether he could do some meetings around the country. So obviously we'd be contacting you if he can to see if you could put one on up here, which I'm sure would be good for, you know, he's a very good guy. Yeah.
Could you mention this event on the 20th? So again, co-organiser of Stop the War and Martin Luther King. And it should be a superb event. Neil Faulkner's a great speaker, big overview, Marxist history of the world, a look at the causes of the First World War. And then Clive Barrett, who's... works in the Peace Museum in Bradford. He's done research on Christian and socialist conscientious objectors from Yorkshire and North East to the First World War. So you'll have this big global overview and a focus on some of the individuals involved in that. So it should be a great event to invite your friends to.
Thanks very much. Sorry, Connor, we didn't get your answer about digital, but I'm sure you can speak to one.
You give us an answer.